I'm very happy to have in the studio with me Kay Havens from the Chicago Botanic Garden. Now, sometimes you go by and pull that microphone just so you can talk right into it. You can pull it towards you as well. It won't break. I broke one last week, but that was a different story. Hi. It's great to talk to you again. Now, do you prefer Kay or Kayrie? What do you prefer?
Kay is fine.
Kay? Mm-hmm. Kayrie's a very interesting, odd name.
It is. My grandmother made it up.
Oh, did she really?
Yes.
And it just gets you in trouble, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't, you know, nobody knows how to pronounce it, right? Nobody knows how to spell it.
Exactly.
I know how those things go. So K, we'll go with K. And you should know that K Havens, Ph.D., Dr. Havens, is the Director of Plant Science and Conservation at the Chicago Botanic Garden. And you and I haven't spoken on the radio since I was back at Gargantua Radio down the dial. So I'm so happy to have you here.
It's lovely to see you again.
It's good to see you, too. Meanwhile, we can bring in Scott Hoffman Black, who's the executive director of the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Are you with me, Scott?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. And Kay is in the studio. And you guys next Friday are doing a day-long seminar on which is called Make Way for Monarchs, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And as we know, the monarchs seem to be in trouble. And whether they are in serious trouble or it's a dip in the population, it doesn't look good right now, Kay, does it?
No, it doesn't. This symposium actually came about. Gary Paul Nabhan is a co-organizer of Make Way for Monarchs, and he talked to me about 8 months ago, said he was looking for venues in the Midwest to host talks and symposia about the plight of monarchs and what we can do to help recover them. And so that's how this symposium came to be. And Scott is one of the speakers. He'll be speaking both at the symposium on Friday and at our World Environment Day celebration on Saturday.
And that's the other thing we should mention is that next Saturday is World Environment Day. And you've got more going on. I mentioned Tom Skilling earlier in the show, and he's going to be there.
Right.
You got to get Rick DeMaio out there. Rick's great. Okay. Yeah, I know Tom's. Yeah, yeah. He's a rock star. But you know what? Rick is my guy.
Yeah. So we have both Tom Skilling and Don Wibbles in the morning talking about climate change.
Uh-huh.
And then at 1 p.m., we'll have Scott in the science building talking about Make Way for Monarchs and what you can do to help recover monarch populations. And in addition, we'll have Asclepias tuberosa, butterfly milkweed, for giveaway for attendees to both the symposium and Scott's talk on Saturday.
Oh, that's wonderful to give away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Great. You know, I had an interesting thing. Maybe you can help me with this yesterday. And I think I was misinformed. And maybe Scott or UK can tell me. I was going to pick up some milkweed. And you know, my whole deal now is I call it butterfly plant. All right. We got to rebrand, Scott. Stop calling it a weed because people won't plant it. I mean, in Chicago, and you know about this, Kay, people have been fined for growing milkweed or butterfly or monarch plant in their front yards in Chicago, which is absurd because there's a real difference between turf grass that is overgrown and native plants. And if you can't tell the difference, you're not trying very hard. All right. It's the way I feel about it,
but
I could be wrong. But, you know, old habits die hard. And sometimes we need to just rename things so that people think about them in a different way. So if you called it monarch plant and you said, hey, everybody's got to put monarch plant in their yard, I think more people might step up and do it.
And I couldn't agree more. And we've been calling it monarch flower.
Okay.
As a way to, because it's got a beautiful flower, and those flowers are beneficial for all sorts of bees, other butterflies, as well as monarchs, and the monarchs eat the plant. So I could not agree more. Let's stop calling it milkweed.
Yeah, just get it out of there. Get the whole thing because it just causes too many problems. And anytime you call anything a weed, people think it's a weed, whether it's a beneficial plant or not. Monarch Flower. Okay, I'll start using that. Maybe I have to amend my own marketing campaign here. Monarch Flower smells wonderful. It's a beautiful plant, and it looks exotic. It is an exotic looking plant as well.
It's a lovely plant, and there are actually 19 species of milkweed native to Illinois, and you can find one that's suited to your conditions. Common milkweed, which is the monarch flower, can be a little bit aggressive in small spaces, but it's wonderful for larger grassland areas.
Yeah, but when you say aggressive, it's not a plant that is hard to dig out.
No, it's not. And it's invasive species.
Right. So. It's not. I mean, yeah, it can be aggressive. It'll move along. And so you don't want that many. You take a few out. It's not like buckthorn. Okay?
Exactly. It's not. and it has lovely flowers. And then there's swamp milkweed.
All right, and I need to stop you right there because Robbie Earhart from Mighty House, which is on Saturdays here. Hey, Rob, just letting you know, we got a, thanks. Robbie Earhart asked me to buy her some, milkweed. Monarch flower at the plant sale yesterday out in Will County. And the only thing they had was the Asclepias incarnata, which is the swamp monarch flower.
Yes.
And I didn't know whether she had wet soil, so I didn't get it. And then I put that on Facebook, and somebody said, oh, come on, you can grow that stuff anywhere.
You can. It doesn't mind its feet wet, and in nature you find it in damper areas, but I have it growing right along the side of my driveway in a pretty dry area, and it's doing just fine.
I screwed up. Robbie, I'm sorry. Should have gotten those for you. I wanted them for myself as well, too, so... maybe I can get Kelsey Shaw. Kelsey Shaw, if you're listening, save a few of those plants for me, or I can get them someplace else. So that's another. There are various kinds of Asclepias that you can plant. But that's part of our problem. Let's address the issue here. I mean, we want people to put monarch flower in their yards. Let's face it, we do. That would be a really, really good thing, but. Is that going to be enough?
I will go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, Scott.
Well, I would say so. Monarchs have declined by more than 90%. This is not a blip. Throughout the late 90s and early 2000s, we saw some ups and downs, but the last several years, it's just been down. And monarchs have gone from potentially half a billion animals, half a billion, which is pretty incredible. Down to 33 million. 33 million, it sounds like a lot, but compared to the incredible numbers that we've had in the 90s, we are seeing severe, severe declines. And if we're going to deal with this issue, we have to deal with it on all levels. It's wonderful, and we really encourage people to plant milkweed. But we also have to get milkweed back out into the larger landscapes in our farm areas, in our wild areas, and bigger patches of milkweed. Not just milkweed, though. All of the nectar plants that would go along with it, which fuel monarch's flight, because they both need milkweed to eat to lay eggs on, and so the caterpillars can eat, and they need these other flowers to fuel their flight and their incredible migration.
That's right, Scott. And if you go to my website, mikenovak.net, go to this week's show, I do a little rundown of the problems that monarchs are facing, and it seems as though it's threefold. There's a triple threat out there, okay? First is deforestation in Mexico of the area where they overwinter. Second, and I addressed this with Rick DeMille earlier in the show, drought in Texas and Oklahoma, in the central part of the country where monarchs have migratory routes. And third is the one you just talked about, Scott, which is lack of habitat, the loss of habitat. And I was talking to a guy yesterday out in Will County who's got a brother or a cousin or something that's got a farm, and we were talking about hedgerows because I've talked about hedgerows on the show before and how important they might be. And he says, well, you know, I said, you got to tell your brother he's got to put some leave some room for some of these plants, some hedgerows. He says, well, he tells me the equipment won't, it just doesn't allow for that anymore. It's too big. And I'm like, well, if we're at that point where we've built the equipment to exterminate our hedgerows and exterminate our boundaries where we have local habitat, we're screwed. You know, if it's all about putting in one more row of corn because we're going to get 10 cents for that because the margin for survival for these farmers is that tight, we're done. We're cooked because we're going to lose all of our pollinators. Scott, how do you address that?
Well, we address it by working with farmers, and I would contend that farmers do get it. So this one may not, but many, many do. You know, Xerces has 28 staff working across the country, working mostly with farmers, although also with land managers and gardeners. We've reached out to over 26,000 farmers and ag professionals since 2008 on this issue, both pollinators and monarchs. And we've worked with them to get more than 120,000 acres of new habitats. These are everything from hedgerows to flowering meadows, and tens of thousands of acres of them have milkweed in them. So I think that farmers are getting it. Their equipment we can work around equipment issues. You know, in the past, universities and others told them, though, that this habitat was not useful. And in certain times, universities told them that this habitat could be harmful by harboring pests of crops, that the information was wrong. But farmers are really, at least many of them that we work with, these are both conventional and organic farmers, really do see the importance of putting habitat back into these landscapes, which helps all the bees and the butterflies and the monarchs. I will add one more thing to your list, though, of issues with monarchs, and that is pesticides.
Yeah, you're right. We have to, that has to be in there. Yes. Well, that's kind of connected to the habitat area. But as you mentioned, we've gotten to this part, the situation where we have Roundup Ready plants, and so we spray Roundup more and more. And by the way, creating super weeds because we abuse the Roundup, and then of course it kills the pollinator attracting plants, and we're left with nothing but the corn and the soybeans.
Right.
You're right. The pesticides have played a huge role in this.
Well, and all of those crops that you're talking about, the Roundup Ready, are also treated with what are called neonicotinoids.
Yes.
98% of the Roundup Ready corn and soybean is treated with these systemic insecticides. They're taken up into the plant. The pollen and nectar is affected and can affect both bees as well as butterflies. These neonicotinoids are the dust when they plant them blows off, and they're getting all into every place in the environment. So it's the Roundup Ready, but it's really the 1-2 punch of we're eliminating all of the habitat for these animals, and we're poisoning what's left of that habitat.
Amazing. I said something yesterday when I was speaking out at Will County, and it, I think more and more becomes evident. We introduced neonicotinoids into the system, around 2003, right? Something like that?
Well, the first ones came on the market actually in 1995.
But oh, okay.
In 2003, they were used really widely throughout the system.
Right. And colony collapse disorder became a problem in 2006. And it's kind of hard not to draw the line, connect those dots. It really is, because you figure it takes a few years for these chemicals to get into our biosphere, as if you would, And then suddenly we're losing bees at an incredible rate. And we're also losing natural pollinators, aren't we, Scott?
Native. Yeah, the native pollinators are really in decline. Of course, we talked about the monarch with over 90% of decline, of losing 90% of their populations. A new analysis that we have just completed working with scientists across the country shows that 1/3 of our bumblebees in North America are at risk of extinction. 1/3. And that's huge because these are animals that are very, very important for our agricultural production, but also vital for pollinating 85% of the flowering plants that are out there. And these flowering plants are what feed your songbirds. Everything from songbirds to grizzly bears eat the product of pollination. So we should all be concerned, and we should all be taking action.
Well, as Doug Tallamy says in his book, Bringing Nature Home, it's about insect biomass. We lose our insect biomass. We lose our birds. We lose our mammals. It just works its way up the chain. I think it's interesting, Scott, that you... You kind of called out some of the old practices, which, you know, weren't particularly forward looking. That hedgerows might actually be dangerous is a silly idea when you think about it, because it was all focused on the pests. What is the pest that's going to hurt the crop? And and we have to look at a bigger picture than that in a more sustainable system. On the phone is Scott Hoffman Black, who's the executive director of the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. You guys are based in Portland, is it?
Well, we've got offices all across the United States. Our closest office to you is in Minnesota, but we've got Nebraska, North Carolina, and I can't think of them all. New Jersey, Texas, California, and our main office is Portland, Oregon.
Right. Kay Havens, Director of Plant Science and Conservation at Chicago Botanic Gardens, here in the studio with me. And Scott, you guys need a branch in Chicago.
Yes, we do. I'll be there. Maybe I'll start looking for one as I'm there next week.
Just look for a headquarters here. I'm going to get to the bee thing first, but let's... get back to the monarchs and what's happening at the Chicago Botanic Garden on Friday. So what's the plan of action, Kay?
Well, the plan of action is an all-day symposium. We start at 9 a.m. and go to 4:30 p.m. We'll be featuring Gary Nabhan as our keynote speaker. He'll be talking about food chain restoration and what that means both for pollinators and for human food security. Mm-hmm. And then we have a couple of folks talking about the plight of the monarchs and the status of monarch populations, including Chip Taylor. And then we'll talk a little bit.
Chip Taylor, by the way, we thought we were going to have him this morning. He's from Monarch Watch, and we can't figure out why we can't get a hold of him. But, he'll be there, so you can see him
on
Friday.
You can talk to him on Friday.
On Friday, right. And while I've stopped you, and I'm sorry about that, if folks have questions about monarchs or planting monarch flower in their yard, 773-763-9278. Would love to hear from you. We'll answer your question. 773-763-9278. The lovely Rob Carthol waiting to take your call. So back to the session.
Yeah, and then in the afternoon, we'll be covering some of the citizen science activities surrounding monarchs, ways that homeowners can get involved, school kids can get involved. We'll be talking about some local conservation efforts for butterflies in general with Doug Tarin from the Peggy Notabart Museum.
He was on the show recently. So,
and then the end of the day, we'll be winding it up with Scott, who's on the phone, and he'll be summing up the plight of the monarch and how large landscape managers can help save the species.
That's a really good point, too. Large landscape managers, who I imagine... until recent times, shunned the use of common milkweed. Who might have been willing to go with swamp milkweed or with the butterfly weed, you know? But the common, it's Are we getting better at that?
I think we are. I think for a long time it was kind of viewed as a common roadside weed.
Exactly. If you can see it on the roadside, why would you have it in your garden? Yeah. My feeling is I've tried to get roadside plants in my garden sometimes.
Because they're tough.
They are. Exactly.
And this one in particular is really lovely, and it's an important nectar source and, of course, the larval food source for monarchs.
And that's a really good point. Some people will say, well, I see monarchs on my butterfly bush.
And they're taking nectar from many flowers, and it's important to have nectar sources throughout the season for monarchs, but they can only lay their eggs and grow their caterpillars on Asclepias or milkweed.
And I think it's important to point out that there are plants, yes, there are non-natives, and perhaps even other natives that they take nectar from, but to live and grow and reproduce, monarchs must have milkweed.
Or monarch flower.
That's okay. Well, the people know who are listening now know what we're talking about here. And I think that's important. Scott, I want to get back to what happened last year in Oregon. You guys had, and I say you guys, I mean the state. What a strange year. You had a 50,000 bumblebee die-off because of misuse of neonicotinoids, which is what we discussed that chemical family earlier. Wilsonville, Oregon. But there were four different incidents in Oregon. The one in Wilsonville was the most egregious, was it not?
Yes, it was by far the largest, but we know of four incidents of neonicotinoids being applied, actually totally under the law. Nobody broke the law, and we killed in one instance 50,000 bees. In the other instance, hundreds, if not thousands, of bees. But what I would tell you, Mike, is I think this is the tip of the iceberg. All of these, all of the events that we know about, were over concrete. So when these bees died, they fell on concrete and people saw them. Mm. Most of the applications of these chemicals are in parks and in yards and in grassy areas. And you would not notice, if the grass is kind of long, you wouldn't notice even hundreds of bees in the grass. So I would contend, although we know of four, that this is a much, much bigger issue. It's likely just the tip of the iceberg.
That's disturbing. Because what happened in Wilsonville, apparently, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you've been following this and covering this, is that a local commercial pesticide operator, licensed operator, was spraying linden trees that were in flower. And, of course, they were attracting bees, the bumblebees. And they were spraying with a neonicotinoid. Dinotefuran, is that how you pronounce it, or dinotefuran?
Dinotefuran is how I pronounce it, but you're potato, potato.
Yeah, okay, great. Because the bees were there, they were exposed to the dinotefuran and died. And what I read about that incident was that the trees were being sprayed prophylactically because the landscaper or the pesticide operator was afraid that there might be honeydew that would fall on people's cars, even though nobody had ever complained about it. Is that correct?
That's what we heard as well. And, you know, that's one of the things about these chemicals that is really problematic. The vast majority, well, I don't know, in many, many cases, they're used prophylactically. They're not needed, yet they're used as an insurance policy in case we've got a pest. And just to be clear, in that case, they were spraying while the trees were in flower. What is almost more concerning, and they shouldn't have been, but what's more concerning in the other three bee kills the application was done in March, and it was done totally under the label regulations, and yet bees still died in the hundreds in June when the tree flowered.
Oh, my goodness. So it lasted that long. It persisted that long.
Yes. In certain plants, imidacloprid, which is the most used of these neonicotinoids, in a rhododendron, we know that it has lasted and is detectable in pollen and nectar after 6 years from one application. 6 years.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Now, here's the one. Here's what got me, because I found this out earlier this year, that the total penalties handed out in Oregon amounted to $2,886. Licensed commercial pesticide operator was fined $555. Each of two applicators was fined $555. There was a civil penalty in the amount of $407 for applying a pesticide product inconsistent with its labeling, and that was in connection to the downtown Portland, which was a different incident. I look at this and I say, well, if there's no penalty, if you can spray with impunity, you said they were done legally, but there were still 50,000 dead bees, dead bumblebees. So how do we change those laws to make it hurt when you do something stupid like that? Because what it was rampant stupidity at work here.
Yes. Well, I'd say there's two things going on, and we're trying to work on both. Is one, we want better labeling, and we want labeling that has the force of law. That's the job of the Environmental Protection Agency. And because their labeling is, one, extremely ambiguous, and two, in most cases, there's no force of law behind it if you break the label. If you don't follow the label, you get a slap on the wrist. That this is very, very important that we improve the labeling for all pesticides. I see it as a right-to-know issue. You know, you can go and buy these neonicotinoids off the shelf at many, many garden stores, and it is very, very difficult and sometimes impossible to find out that they kill bees. So anybody can just, they pick them up. Oh, this will save my roses. I'll have perfect roses. Why don't I put this down? And there's nothing on the label, or it's in 9-point font on the back. The other issue is that most light, quote-unquote, licensed applicators actually do not have to take any tests on these neonicotinoid products. To understand pollinators at all. And that's really the second issue, is that we really need more mandatory education if somebody's going to be spraying these toxic insecticides, because you shouldn't be able to spray and kill 50,000 bumblebees and get a $500
fine. $500 fine. So what is it? I don't know the math on it, but it's like $10 per $5 per 10,000 bees or something like that. I don't know, or 1,000 bees. It's just ridiculous.
It's really ridiculous.
Actually, I've got Nick on the line here who's calling in. And Nick, I'm told, let's try that again. There we go. Nick, I'm told you're a licensed pesticide applicator. Nick? All right. He's listening to the radio. If you can talk to him, Rob, tell him he can't. He's got to listen to the phone, not the radio. Let me take a short break here and get back to Kay and Scott. I just had to bring that up, Scott, because when I found out what the fine was, my head exploded. I just said, you're kidding me. You got to be kidding me that this is the best we can do. Well, no wonder our pollinators are dropping dead and we're losing them at an incredible rate, because we don't pay it attention, and we let that. Are we back with Nick?
Hello.
Hi. You wanted
about that.
No, that's okay. Yeah, you got to be careful because folks, they tend to listen to their radio. And we're on a delay here, so you have to actually listen to the phone if you get on the line. So you're a you're a licensed pesticide applicator.
Yes, sir. I'm a certified arborist, so I do with the trees, and then I've gotten the Illinois pesticide licensing. And I'm listening, and I know with labeling, Scott was mentioning we need to do more with labeling and that. I think it goes deeper than that. I think it goes that we need to completely change our culture and actually find a way to get away from all this because, you know, I'll go out and let's say for a company we're working for, and your salespeople will sell. There's a tree problem with someone's got a problem with their trees. I use the example of the Austrian pines, and they're plagued with Zimmerman pine moth. And one of the pesticides spray is a pesticide to kill that moth. But the pesticide doesn't distinct between moths, a Zimmerman pine moth, or a butterfly in Lepidoptera. You know, it's going to kill everybody. Same thing with like imidacloprids that were used to kill emerald ash borer in the ash trees. If you use a soil drench application of that insecticide around the base of the tree, you can come back within about 10 minutes and discover a whole bunch of dead earthworms. And it's just my dilemma, and I'm sure a lot of dilemma, is how do you go about not treating these things, making, you know, this is like an employment, so we're trying to make a living for everybody, not just me, but other people as well. You know, and trying to combat these things, it's more than just labeling. We need to completely change our culture.
I couldn't agree with you more, although there are people who will tell you that if we want to save our ash trees, this is one of the treatments. Of course, there's other treatments as well. You don't necessarily have to use imidacloprid, and you're nodding there, Kay.
Yeah, I mean, there are other treatments as well, and they found that some of the imidacloprid, if you inject it into the tree, it's not as, they're finding it's not as toxic to the bees and to the pollen sometimes. But sometimes there's, if you put more in, it might, you know, there's a variable. How much do you put in? If you put a little extra, does it affect it more or less?
I wanted Kay to address that here in the studio. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there are things other than pesticides as well. There's breeding programs to try to create ash trees that are more resistant to emerald ash borer, and that relies on having the seeds from ashes in seed banks so that we can use them in future breeding programs.
And seeds from ashes that have survived emerald ash borer, because what is it that tree has? What characteristics does it have that we might be able to breed into a new variety of ash that will be able to withstand the attack?
Right. So one thing the garden is doing, and as well as our partners in Seeds of Success, which is a national native seed banking program, is targeting taxa like the ash to collect before they're completely wiped out and really focus on ones that appear to be somewhat resistant. And then maybe we can get away from using pesticides and really focus on planting the right plants in the right place.
But, Nick, I think your point is well taken that we have to start thinking differently. It's like when I talk to people about weeds, what the heck is a weed? And who died and made you God? And you can tell me what a weed is like clover. Clover's not a weed. I'm sorry. Clover is a nut. And clover's a nitrogen fixer. Clover's what?
Clover's wonderful.
Yes, it is. It is absolutely. But we got people out there trying to kill it.
Yeah.
I get people call and they go, how do I kill moss? Why do you want to kill moss? It's green. It's not, you know, people buy moss, sell it, and make some money. Keep raising it and sell it and make some money.
Craft stores. You can buy it in a bag in a craft store and put water on it, and it's back to normal.
Right. Now, in the Pacific Northwest, it's a little different. Scott, as you know, people find moss to be pernicious. But in the Midwest, I always wonder when they're trying to kill it. Scott, I'd be interested in your take on what Nick has said.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I was talking about specifics that we're trying to do right now, but I think we need a cultural shift. know, one thing we haven't pointed out is oftentimes more insecticides are used per acre, more pesticides are used per acre in urban and suburban environments than they are in agricultural environments. And I think we need, and I think Kay is right on, and we need to educate the public about the right plants in the right place. That is the first thing. And then the second thing is a few blemishes on a plant is not the end of the world. You don't need a perfect lawn. You don't need a perfect rose. And I would intend, even with ash, in the long term, do we want to a toxic environment to maintain these tree species? We need to think about this in the really long term there. Yeah. As we talked about breeding programs, but there are other trees that we can start to replace some of these trees with. So lots of options, but we do need a wholesale change in people's attitudes to their lawns and gardens and trees. And having them be there for wildlife and enjoyment is more important than having them be perfect without a blemish.
Great comment, Nick. Thank you so much for calling. You have a great Sunday.
Thank you.
Whoops, sorry to cut you off there, dude. Okay, before we wrap things up here, let's talk a little bit about World Environment Day and what you guys are doing.
Right, so World Environment Day, the Garden celebrates the first Saturday in June every year, and it's the day that we showcase our environmental sustainability practices and our plant conservation practices to the public. Almost all the staff will be on site that day. They're there to answer questions. We'll have demonstrations about
On a Saturday. Oh, my goodness.
We'll be showing off our research in the science building. Folks can go to the Butterfly and Blooms exhibit, which has a wide variety of butterflies.
I've been there. It's really cool.
It's
if you
really
haven't
fun.
Been to Butterfly and Blooms, you got to go.
And then we'll have some great talks. We mentioned Tom Skilling and Don Wibbles in the morning on climate change, and then Scott Black in the afternoon on monarchs. And so I think it'll be a great day for the entire family. And that's
the idea, is we've got to get families involved in this, and it starts with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Teach them. If we're going to change our mindset, that's where it's going to have to begin. Scott, do you want to give me a quick preview of what you're going to say? You got about a minute.
Yes. Well, I'm going to talk about the incredible journey of the monarch butterfly. This is an animal that flies 2,500 miles to forests north of Mexico City and then makes its way back over successive generations. And I'm going to talk about how we may not see this butterfly in our yards in the coming decade, but there are things that everybody can do to change this scenario so we have monarchs for future generations.